1 Samuel chapter 31. We are finishing our study through the book of 1 Samuel this morning, and we'll read the chapter in its entirety together. So 1 Samuel chapter 31, starting to read in verse 1. Now the Philistines were fighting against Israel, and the men of Israel fled from before the Philistines and fell slain on Mount Gilboa. And the Philistines overtook Saul and his sons, and the Philistines killed Jonathan and Abinadab and Malchishua, the sons of Saul. And the battle went heavily against Saul, and the archers hit him, and he was badly wounded by the archers. Then Saul said to his armor bearer, "Draw your sword and pierce me through with it, lest these uncircumcised come and pierce me through and make sport of me." But his armor bearer would not, for he was greatly afraid. So Saul took his sword and fell on it. And when his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell on his sword and died with him. Thus Saul died with his three sons, his armor bearer, and all his men on that day together. When the men of Israel who were on the other side of the valley with those who were beyond the Jordan saw that the men of Israel had fled and that Saul and his sons were dead, they abandoned the cities and fled. Then the Philistines came and lived in them. And it came about on the next day, when the Philistines came to strip the slain, that they found Saul and his three sons fallen on Mount Gilboa. And they cut off his head and stripped off his weapons and sent them throughout the land of the Philistines to carry the good news to the house of their idols and to the people. And they put his weapons in the temple of Ashtaroth, and they fastened his body to the wall of Beth Shan. Now when the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead heard what the Philistines had done to Saul, all the valiant men rose and walked all night and took the body of Saul and the bodies of his sons from the wall of Bethshan, and they came to Jabesh and burned them there. And they took their bones and buried them under the tamarisk tree at Jabesh and fasted 7 days. Well, as we began our study through the book of 1 Samuel last September, we noted that the books of 1 and 2 Samuel cover about 150 years of Israel's history, from 1120 B.C. with Samuel's birth to 971 B.C. when David, on his deathbed, appointed Solomon, his son, to follow him as king of Israel. The events today are happening about 1011 B.C., so about 100 years into that 150-year progression. And the earliest manuscripts that scholars have today of 1 and 2 Samuel make no division in the book. It's just one solid manuscript. The division between 1 and 2 Samuel did not occur until a Greek translation of the Old Testament was made, which is called the Septuagint. And it's important for us to remember that originally there was not a break between 1 and 2 Samuel, because 1 Samuel appears to end on a very down note with the death of Saul, but actually, right after this, Israel's going to experience some great joy as their king, their new king David, understands his role as God's representative on earth and seeks after God with his whole heart. You see, 1 Samuel 31 is not the end of the story. But it's here for a purpose, as is all of the accounts in the books of 1 and 2 Samuel. We noted when we started our study that this is not just a mere history, but the events recorded for us in 1 and 2 Samuel are here to teach us lessons. And some of the lessons we have seen revolve around the themes of trust and obedience and walking with the Lord. And we've seen what happens when people put their total dependence on the Lord and walk in obedience to Him. And we've also seen some times with both Saul and David when they've failed to trust Him. And just as is true today was true then, that God's grace, His forgiveness, His enablement, is always there for His people. Even in David's failures, God's grace is there. Sometimes we as Christians today can think about God's grace in ways which we tend to think, you know, if I do my own thing here, or if I just live my life the way I want to, God will still forgive me, and He will. The Apostle Paul talked about that in Romans chapter 6 when he said, well, if God's grace is so great and so vast beyond measure, should I just sin more so I can experience more of God's grace? And Paul answered his own rhetorical question quickly by saying, no way! How should we who died to sin still live in it? In other words, if I've been freed from the bondage of my sin nature as a Christian, I don't have to sin anymore, why should I continue living in sin? And one of the things that we're going to note today in 1 Samuel chapter 31 is that while there is a tendency in our hearts and our lives to think that I sin and I get away with it, to think that, well, I'll sin, but God will just forgive me, and really no one even knows. While that sometimes can be our tendency, the reality is this, that there's consequences to disobedience. When we sin against God, there's always a consequence. Even though His grace is there and we do find forgiveness in Him, we see here in 1 Samuel chapter 31, and most of us could attest to it personally, when we sin, our sin doesn't affect just us, it affects those around us. And there's always a consequence to our sin. And in chapter 31, we see that played out. Even though sometimes we think our actions just affect me. My wife and I live over on the edge of Toddville. Very small. I'm not sure if they're even incorporated. I don't think it is. Maybe it is. I don't know. Village. And the benefit of living where we do is I can just go a couple hundred yards and really feel like I'm in the country. And I enjoy just in the evenings going for a run around our section, and I see deer and turkey and occasional skunk, and I'm just away from it all. I don't take my phone. It's just really peaceful. This spring I was out for a walk with my wife, and an eastern towhee flew right in front of me, and I walked about another 100 yards, and a scarlet tanager flew right across us. It was great. So I enjoy those times when I just am out around the section on which we live. One of the downsides of where we live is that people also think, since it's somewhat rural, they can just dump their garbage wherever they want to dump it. And periodically I'll be out for a serene run just by myself, and I'll be coming along the road, and I'll come around a corner, and somebody's thrown an old mattress right in the ditch. And I'm sure they came at after dark, and they thought, oh, I'll just save myself a few bucks. I won't go to the landfill. I'll just go throw it out in the ditch, and no one will know. And they take off. Hopefully, someplace in the recesses of that person's mind, there's a little voice that says, you know, you weren't really being a good citizen when you dumped that in the ditch. Hopefully, they will ponder that and not have a complete peace about it. Not realizing that whatever we do affects those around us. And here I am, just out for my run and enjoying nature and the scarlet tanagers and the deer and the turkey, and then I come across this old urine-stained mattress in the road. It affected me. Eventually, somebody from the county is probably going to have to come by and pick up that old gross mattress and on taxpayer nickels go put it in the landfill where it belongs. You see, our actions don't affect just us. They affect a lot of people around us. And one of the things that Saul experiences today in 1 Samuel chapter 31 is that not only is he going to experience God's discipline in his life, but his actions, even though for years he certainly must have thought, I'll just do what I want to do. Nothing's going to happen to me. Eventually it did. And it affected not just himself, but those around him. So let's look, first of all, at the first six verses here in 1 Samuel chapter 31. As we see that sometimes God brings discipline today. Not just in the eternal future. And sometimes we as believers tend to think that discipline or judgment is only going to happen down the road. Sometime in eternity God will judge people for their sin. But here now, hey, people sin all the time, they get away with it, nothing happens. Not true. And we're going to see in the first six verses that God sometimes brings judgment and discipline now, not just in the future. Notice with me in verse 1, it says, the Philistines were fighting against Israel, and the men of Israel fled from before the Philistines and fell slain on Mount Gilboa. Now remember, in chapter 9, verse 16, when God commissioned the prophet Samuel to go anoint Saul as Israel's king, there was a charge that came along with that anointing, and that was that Saul was to free the people of Israel from Philistine attack. Saul was supposed to put down the Philistines. And yet today in chapter 31, we see how dismally Saul performed. Because of his disobedience to God, because he never really wanted to accept his role as God's representative on earth, meaning that God was Israel's true king, Saul was God's representative. Saul wanted the power himself. Saul wanted to do what he wanted to do. And he never really came to grips with the fact that God was the one in charge. And because of that, Saul did not fulfill God's purpose for him. And instead of Saul putting on the Philistines win here in chapter 31. And we see it tells us Israel fled from them. And in verse 2, three of Saul's sons are killed. Jonathan, that man of God that came alongside of David on so many occasions, and Abinadab and Malchishua. And the battle was going so bad that Saul didn't want the Philistines to, in a sense, torture him. Remember, the book of Judges ran concurrently with the book of 1 Samuel, at least part of it. It hasn't been that long ago in history that we found in Judges chapter 16 recorded for us that the Philistines gouged out the eyes of Samson. Saul didn't want anything grotesque happening to him, so he asked his sword bearer to go ahead and kill him. His sword bearer refused. Most likely, just as David refused to lift his hand against the anointed king of God, so also the sword bearer said, I'm not going to take the king's life. So Saul runs his own sword through himself. And then it tells us, the armor bearer followed suit. You see, years before, God had told Saul, because of your disobedience, I'm going to remove the kingdom from your descendants. If Saul would have responded to God at that point, yielded his heart to him, God would have still used Saul as king. But then Saul just became more hard-hearted and ignored God more. And God said, I'm not only going to take the kingdom from your descendants, I'm taking the kingdom from you. And yet, Saul continued in disobedience. He didn't turn away from his sin. Certainly Saul must have thought, well, I've gotten away with it so far, I'll just continue to disobey. Now, 40 years later, while Saul thought discipline would never come, it comes. When I was a kid, I had a bank, you know, like a piggy bank, except this one wasn't a pig. It was the coolest bank I knew. It was a box with a little platform on the front of it. And you put a quarter, hopefully a quarter, on the front, and you pressed a button, and a hand would come out of the box and grab your quarter and pull it back in. It was great. It was cool. Love that bank. And as a little tiny kid, I'm not sure I really understood where that quarter went, but I knew it was gone. It was inside of that box somewhere. Out of sight, out of mind. And I think Saul kind of views his sin that way. You know, God has been so patient with him, and he keeps disobeying God, and yet he continues to rule, and he seems to do what he wants to do, and it just seems to go on and go on. Just like, well, I've banked it away someplace, don't know quite where it went. And yet, we come to chapter 31, and are reminded once again that God always does what he says he will do. Sometimes it's in his timing, but he always does what he says he will do. And God brings his discipline upon Saul. You see, sometimes God's discipline isn't just for the future. Sometimes it happens now. You know, Hebrews 9:27 makes it very clear. It's appointed for men to die once. After this comes judgment. There will be judgment for all people after our death. For the Christian, for the person who's put their trust in Jesus Christ, it's not a judgment to determine if we go to heaven or not. We're going to heaven. We're sealed with the Spirit of God. Rather, it's a judgment of our works, how we serve Jesus Christ here on this earth. 1 Corinthians 3 talks about it. If we've served well, then we're going to have reward. If we have lived this life for self, we'll suffer a loss of reward, but we'll still have a relationship with Christ. For the non-Christian, that judgment is to be greatly feared. Revelation 20 says that if anyone's name is not found written in the book of life, that person is going to be cast into the lake of fire. It's not a happy thing. And for many of us, we think, well, there is judgment coming, but it's always future. And yet the New Testament is very clear that God does not leave discipline. God does not leave judgment all the time just for the future. For example, we know clearly that God has put mechanisms into place here on this earth that we will suffer if we disobey. For example, the role of government. Revelation chapter 13 makes it very clear that God has put government into place. Romans chapter 13, verses 1 through 4. Let every person be in subjection to the governing authorities, for there's no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. Therefore, he who resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God. They who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. For rulers are not a cause of fear for good behavior, but for evil. Do you want to have no fear of authority? Do what's good, and you'll have praise from the same. For it is a minister of God to you for good. But if you do what's evil, be afraid. For it does not bear the sword for nothing. For it's a minister of God, an avenger who brings wrath upon the one who practices evil. If I willingly choose to disobey the law, I'm going to suffer discipline. And these verses say that that government who is bringing that discipline on me has been given authority from God himself. Those in government today, few recognize that. But they would not be in a position of authority apart from God's permitting them to be in that place. We also see God directly bringing discipline. For example, in the passage we read this morning when we took communion in 1 Corinthians 11, it talks about later in the chapter that that Corinthian church was marked by anger toward each other and a lack of love and forgiveness and self-centeredness, and yet they were still taking communion as if everything was right between them and God. And Paul went on to explain that because they weren't forgiving each other and demonstrating love to each other, it said many of you, among you are weak and sick and a number sleep. God was disciplining them. You see, our discipline does not always wait just until eternity. The other principle we see here in verses 7 through 10 is the fact that when a believer does disobey God, his or her sin affects the whole community. One of the things I always share with my sons is that we don't live on an island. Our actions affect everyone around us. And I point that out quite often. The same thing goes with the Christian community. We don't live on an island. Our disobedience affects the whole community of believers. Notice with me in verse 7. When the men of Israel who were on the other side of the valley, with those who were beyond the Jordan, saw that the men of Israel had fled and that Saul and his sons were dead, they abandoned the cities and fled. Then the Philistines came and lived in them. You see, when the rest of Israel saw Saul's failure, it was so discouraging to them that they gave up. They walked away from their towns and their homes, and the Philistines, who were relegated to a small area down here in the southwest corner of where Egypt and Israel rest, now are in cities right smack in the heart of Israel. It wouldn't have happened apart from the discouragement that set in as a result of Saul's sin. And when the rest of Israel saw Saul's failure, they became despondent. They became filled with fear. You see, Saul's actions affected others. The text goes on to tell us that as the Philistines came in the day after the battle, they found Saul's body and they chopped off his head and took his swords. And they sent his head around to the other Philistine communities as in victory. It tells us in verse 8 that they sent them throughout the land and the Philistines to carry the good news to the house of their idols and to the people. You see, in that ancient Near Eastern mindset, when Israel was defeated, it wasn't just the defeat of a nation. It was the victory of a God over Israel's God. And when Israel fell, in the Philistine mind, their God was greater than Israel's God. You see, Saul's sin brought derision, brought scoffing, not toward only the people of Israel, but to Israel's God. And it tells us in verse 10 that they took Saul's body and hung him on a wall and scoffed at him. Lots of people will go to the lakes this weekend. When we used to live in North Dakota, when we went to the lakes, we went to Minnesota, and there's lots of lakes, and not that many people if you went to the right lake. It's pretty tough to find a lake this weekend here in Iowa that won't be pretty crowded. There's a few places that have a no-wake rule, meaning you can't take a boat, your $45,000 ski boat, down the middle of the lake and create a wake behind the boat that's going to go and affect everybody else. Like Grandpa and his little granddaughter and their canoe who are out fishing with a Snoopy fishing pole near the shore. Now the guy in the $45,000 ski boat who's flying 40 miles an hour across the lake probably isn't even thinking about Grandpa back in the canoe. In fact, they're clear off by the shore. I'm out here in the middle of the lake. They're clear across the lake by the time that wake ever makes it to shore, but boy, is grandpa and granddaughter in for a ride. You see, we tend not to think about the fact that our actions affect people other than ourselves. Saul never thought about the fact that his actions affected the rest of Israel, affected his own sons, at least one of whom we know was a very godly man. Until it's too late. And not only the community of believers, but the one true God's name is being ridiculed because of Saul's actions. The Apostle Paul talks a lot about Christians needing to be mindful of the fact that sin affects the whole community. In 1 Corinthians chapter 5, Paul wrote this in about verse 6 when he said, "Your boasting is not good. Do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump of dough? Clean out the old leaven that you may be a new lump, just as you are in fact unleavened, for Christ our Passover also has been sacrificed." He's telling the Corinthians, who had become proud about a man in the congregation who was having an illicit relationship with his father's wife, and said, "You're proud about this. You don't realize that that man's sin can affect all of you. You've got to deal with it." Later in 2 Corinthians, possibly a reference to that same man, but we're not totally sure, we read in chapter 2, verse 5, this from Paul: "If any has caused sorrow, he has caused sorrow not to me, but in some degree, in order not to say too much to all of you." You see, that man's sin hurt the rest of the community of believers. Saul's sin here hurt the rest of the community of believers. The chapter ends on a high note because it draws attention to a group of what verse 12 refers to as valiant men. Some men from Jabesh-Gilead come and at risk, to their own peril, they walk all night long. When they find out what happened to Saul's body, they go into Philistine territory, take down Saul's body from the wall, and it's in its decomposed state, burned it and buried it. Why did they do that? They did it to protect the dignity of their community in the name of the Lord. You know, those men of Jabesh-Gilead, we saw back in chapter 11 when the Ammonites said, "We're going to come take you captive, and we won't kill you if you're willing to let us pluck out your right eye of each man." And the men of Jabesh-Gilead said, "Well, I guess that's the best deal we're going to get, but give us a couple of days." They sent word to Saul, and Saul's first official act as king was to come and rescue them. They haven't forgotten that. They owe him. But I don't think that's the only reason why they risked their lives. They were valiant men. And they saw one of their community on a wall being mocked. Ultimately, mocking the name of the one true God. And they took him down to protect the dignity of their community and their God. There's a verse in 1 Corinthians chapter 16, verse 13, that says this: "Be on the alert. Stand firm in the faith. Act like men. Be strong." That's what these guys did. They acted like true men of God. In 2006, the media became fascinated with the fall of Ted Haggard, pastor of a megachurch he founded in Colorado Springs, president of the National Association of Evangelicals. He was one of us. And accusations came out of drug abuse and illicit physical relationships. In fact, he was just back in the news here in 2011 for illicit reports of illicit behavior. And my, didn't the secular world have fun with that? You could turn on a Letterman or something, and in a sense, they put Ted Haggard on that wall. You see, when someone, anyone within the community of believers sins, it doesn't just affect that person. It affects the whole community of believers. Does God forgive? His grace is boundless. Of course God forgives. Paul acknowledged that in Romans 6. But sin has consequences. And every time a Ted Haggard or someone who's known to be a Christian sins, and it's public, the secular world loves to take that quote-unquote body and lay it on the wall. How do we respond as a community of believers? How do we act as valiant men? One of the first things we need to do is remind people who are putting them up on the wall that Christianity isn't about men, it's about Christ. That all of us fail, all of us have sin, all of us fall short, and we are not to be looking at each other as our measure, but as Jesus Christ. It's a time for us to pray for our community. It's a time for us to resolve in our own hearts to depend on the Lord and learn and walk in purity. We've seen through the book of 1 Samuel some real highs and some real lows. But all the way we've seen God's grace. We've seen God's enablement. We've seen that God always does what he says he will do. Even when he says he'll bring discipline. Our response as we look at the life of Saul and the life of David, hopefully it's, I want to be a David. I want to have a heart that's after God's heart. I want to keep a short account with the Lord and confess my sin and not turn a deaf ear to him. Because sin always has consequence. Father, I thank you for this chapter, for the encouragement the book of 1 Samuel brings to our lives. And I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.